Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, I'm Tom Phillips, and I'm a member of this congregation. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. Whatever your faiths that you've known or the flags of your heritage, you're welcome here. Whoever you are and whomever you love, you're welcome here. And whether you ran in here today on little feet or walked in briskly or ambled in or rolled in, you're welcome here. So now I'd like everyone to welcome each other, which requires standing. But before that, there's something I wanted to, standing or leaning over. But I have some suggestions. You don't have to follow them. But John Alou, just, hi. Hi, John Alou.
Hi, Tom.
Nice to see you.
Hi.
Hey,
you
know, I grew up in Pennsylvania near Harrisburg.
Really?
Yeah, where did you grow up?
Virginia.
So we're
both Rowdies.
In the mountains or down below a little bit?
In kind of suburbs of D.C.
Okay. I know that beltway. Okay. So, not as many details maybe, but go at it. Ask about where you've been. Okay, great. Thanks. So we all know a little bit more about each other, right? And that's in the spirit of the theme for today, welcoming and heritage. All right? So along with welcoming everybody here, I want to also invite visitors, if you've not been here before, to sign our guest book at the Narthex area on the welcome table. And on that form, you can request a complimentary subscription to our newsletter, which is very nice to have. Ask that you please check the announcements in our bulletin today. There's a note about a teen lunch, which sounds like fun. And there will also be the first class of a Path to Membership mini-series right after the church. And John Lou has an announcement.
I've been working with some of the students at the university on the stymieing of the Graham Cassidy Act that will take away health care for so many. And there are letter writing materials in the ALSOP room. So when you go in there for coffee, if you want to write a letter, go ahead and do it. And what we're going to do is scan them. They're taking them to D.C. tomorrow.
Wow.
So help us out with that if you can.
Okay, thank you. Now, at this time, we're ready for the chalice lighting, which the young Mr. McGoy will help with. And this is a piece from Paul Sprecher with the title Legacy Chalice Lighting. We light this chalice to honor the memory of those who have come before us, kindling flames of wisdom in dark times, willing to challenge orthodoxy even at great personal risk, giving us a legacy of freedom and a love of truth, a legacy that warms our hearts and lights our paths. Okay, next. The first hymn, opening hymn, is number 148, Let Freedom Span Both East and West.
Thank you.
Well, now is the time in our service where we share our joys and sorrows. And any significant joys or sorrows that you might care to tell us about, please get the microphone from our AV person, Gene Sievers, I believe.
Good morning. My sorrow is that I have somewhat temporarily lost my voice. That's why I'm not able to join the choir today. But my joy is in the response that I've gotten from people in support of one of the folks in my drama therapy program who really needed some support in turning her apartment into a home for her and her kids. She is doing well. She's had her child. She has a two-year-old, and she was pregnant when I last spoke to you, and now she has a baby boy as well. I was able to help deliver some furniture and other things to her, and she's starting to really feel a lot more at home. And I wanted to throw out there, if anyone is aware of a car that might be available that's on the much cheaper end of things, that is one thing that's on the horizon that I think will help make her life a lot more easier. And then also for another one of my friends that is also an international student that could use a microwave. So if you hear anything, just let me know. I'm happy to get things to them. And again, thank you so much for your love and support for our friends who've come from far away to join us here in Kansas.
Thanks, Emily.
Good morning, Enel Forrester. I have a joy and a sadness. My joy is that my sister Diana's youngest child and family lived in Houston, and they watched the flood come up the lawn and recede. They were not flooded out. Her oldest son and family live in Boca Raton, Florida, and they only lost a few trees and were 4 days without power. So that is a relief. It's been a crazy, crazy month. And my sister lives in Mexico City, and as you've heard, the earthquake. They live on the mountainside, so they do not live in the valley on the lake quivering. So far, they are okay. I haven't heard since the second quake, but I'm assuming being on the mountainside that they're okay. So that's sort of my joy. It's been, as I said, a crazy month. My other one is a great sadness. Our friend Laverne Baker. Passed away this couple of weeks ago, and she was very active in our membership when we were building our fellowship hall here, and she even brought her mother several times to visit with us. For some reason, she stopped coming, and when we had our program last Sunday on the welcome, I am wondering if somehow she did not feel quite welcomed by all of us. We lost a wonderful soul who would have been great for this fellowship. And I know Manhattan will miss her. She was quite a wonderful person, and I will miss her. I'm sorry I will not be here to honor her or honor her memorial. I will be out of the country. So that's it.
I have a definite joy. On Friday night, we met here. I'm Pat Embers. Our UU Drum Circle Wonder Workshop and a bunch of people from the community met here for 10 billion beats that went around the world. We had 25 people here. We had all kinds of instruments. We had a bunch of kids and families and young people. So I just want to thank all of those who came or would be interested in that or participated in any way or just like that kind of thing.
Larry Weaver. My joy is that my daughter from Germany has been here and remains here until this Friday. And just having her around has been, she's been quite busy with the program that Elke Lorenz spearheads here in Manhattan. But just having her around to drink coffee with for an hour in the morning is wonderful. So you people who are in your 40s and 50s, think about visiting your parents. They will enjoy it, I promise you.
Or 30.
Okay. For all those joys and concerns shared or in our hearts, let's be in solidarity. All right. At this time, it is Sylvia Beeman. Do I have it correct? It does say now the choir will offer an anthem for today. But don't forget Sylvia. She'll be.
Oh,
Now, for all of those young and young at heart, please come forward to hear Sylvia's story.
Have you ever been far, far away from home? Well, those of you who have been far away, did you miss your home? What did you miss about it?
Knowing where everything is.
Nick said knowing where everything is.
And his cats.
Yes? Oh, that's true. She said that at home you're free to do certain things you really like to do, and then when you're away from your home, you don't have access to your stuff, and, yeah, you can't do it. Well, did you ever go far, far away and no one in your family was there? You have, Ronan? But still, that's different, not with your... Oh.
I've been away from home and away from my direct family, but I've been with my grandparents.
Did you miss your home?
Yeah.
Do you think they missed you?
Probably.
I've been with my aunts away from my nuclear family.
Was it traumatic at all? Or scary?
No, it was pretty fun because they're in California and we went to the beach and stuff.
This is not when I've never been gone without any of my family members, but I've been gone. But my mom has been gone in Morocco for 2 years without any family members.
Same as Ronan.
Far, far away in Africa, there's a village, and the air smells kind of spicy. And in the middle of the village grows a giant mango tree. Three sisters live there. The two older ones are named Tasha and Titi. And, yes? Well, we'll see. There's truth in it. And the little sister's name is Bim Willie. And one day, Tasha and Titi went to their mom. Mama Hawa, it's so hot today. We want to go to the ocean. Can we go? And Mama Hawa said, if you go, you have to take your little sister, Bim Willie. Oh, but we don't want to take her. She's a big pain. Yeah, said Tasha. She walks so slowly, and she's just a nuisance. We don't want to take her. That's fine. Then you can all stay home. Okay, we'll take her. Remember, you must be home before dark, said Mama Hawa. So off they went. They ran through the jungle. They couldn't wait to get there. And they burst out of the trees, and there was the gleaming white sand. And beyond that, there was the sparkling blue water of the ocean. And the waves went whoosh, whoosh. And then they sucked out. Titi and Tasha jumped right in. And they were having so much fun splashing and body surfing. And Bim Willie had never seen the ocean before, and she was really scared. So she just sat there on the sand by herself. And then an especially big wave came. Whoosh! Crash! And when it rolled back out, there on the beach was a gleaming white thing. And Bim Willie went and picked it up, and oh, it's a beautiful shell. And she looked it all over, and she held it to her ear, and it went, shh. She made up a little song. I found a shell from under the sea, a shell the big wave gave to me. It's pink inside like the morning sky. When you listen, you can hear the ocean sigh. Shh. She sang her song over and over, and then a white seagull flew overhead. Krakow! It disappeared, and there on the beach was a big monster, and he had a big, long, gray face and two long, skinny arms, and one was wrapped around his djembe, his drum. And he said, little girl, you sing so sweetly. Come here. She walked a little closer, but she was scared.
Would you like to travel with me? We could go far and wide, and I will play my drum, and people will give us delicious food. You will see many strange things, and you can see. You can sing with me while I play my drum. People will be amazed.
Well, should she go? You think she... Well, my sisters are so mean to me, and I... But before she could even say a word, he opened his drum, and he grabbed her, and he stuffed her inside... And he walked off with her inside the drum into the jungle. Her sisters were having so much fun they didn't even notice. But pretty soon, Titi said, "Oh, the sun is getting low in the sky. We better go home." They ran all the way home, and Mama Hawa was stirring a big pot, and she said, "Oh, girls, did you have a good time? And where's your sister, Bimwilly?" "Oh, we forgot her." "Yes." He ran away. They were so distracted having fun. So they ran all the way back to the ocean. Bimwilly was nowhere to be seen, and the Zimmy was long gone with his djembe. They ran all the way back. Everyone in the village was so upset. They stayed up all night looking for Bimwilly, and people cried and screamed. They looked all the next day and all the next week, and for many weeks they searched for Bimwilly. They searched for her for 2 years, and finally they gave up hope. Meanwhile, Bimwilly was traveling around with the Zimwi inside his drum, and the Zimwi would go into a village and he would say, "I will play my magic drum for you. It's not an ordinary drum that just goes goom, goom, goom. It's a talking, singing drum. And if you will feed me, I will play for you." And the people always said, "Okay, we'll do that. That was exciting." And so Bimwilly would play for them, would sing while the Zimwi played his drum. And then at night, he would go off into the jungle and open the drum and let Bimwilly out. And he always saved some wonderful food for her. But it really wasn't what she expected. She was usually inside a dark drum. That was pretty boring, bumping along the paths in the jungle. But she did see many beautiful new birds and animals and plants, and sometimes the Zimwi let her out in a village, and that was really exciting too. But one day, the Zimwi walked into a village, and Bimwilly inside the drum smelled a kind of a spicy smell on the air, and it reminded her of something. But she was in the drum, so she didn't see that there was a large mango tree growing right in the middle of the village. And the Zimwi said to a woman, "I will play my magic singing drum for you if you will feed me." And the woman said, "Oh, Zimwi, that would be very nice. We will prepare a feast for you." Bimwilly inside the drum said, "I think that's Mama Hawa." And she sang, "I found a shell from under the sea, shell the big wave gave to me. It's dark in here like the midnight sky. If you listen, you can hear Bimwilly cry." But the woman had walked off. She did not hear Bimwilly. But Titi and Tasha heard her, and they ran to Mama Hawa. "Mama Hawa, that's Bimwilly inside the drum." She got a great big pitcher, and she walked up to the Zimwi. Zimwi, would you please fill this pitcher with water down at the river so that I can make your food?"
"Okay, I will."
And he took the big, heavy pitcher with both his arms, and he left his drum. As soon as he was out of sight, Mama Hawa opened the drum, and out jumped Bimwilly. Oh, they'd forgotten her lovely face and the sound of her voice, and they hugged her and kissed her, and she hugged them back. Everyone was so happy to see her, and they were all crying, but they hid her in their hut. And the Zimwi came back with the water, and they prepared a gigantic feast, and everyone stuffed themselves. And then they said, "Oh, Zimwi, you must play your magic singing drum for us."
"Okay, I will."
"We don't hear any singing."
"Sing, little girl, sing."
"Oh, that's just a regular drum, Zimwi. You fooled us. We're going to make you pay for that. Crack out!" The Zimwi disappeared and his djembe, and a white seagull flew up, up, up over the jungle. and the people from the village of the large mango tree never saw him again. That night, they built an enormous fire, and Bimwili told them stories all night long of all the wondrous things that she'd seen, all the delicious food she's eaten, and what it was like traveling around inside a drum. And that's the end of the story about Bimwili, who went very far away from home with none of her family, and how she got back home. And today the adults are going to be talking about coming back home. Thanks for being my audience.
Now is the time for our offering. The offering is a sign and a symbol of our uniting together. Because we offer to this fellowship our time, treasures, and talents, we are able to do more together than we could ever do alone. In that spirit, we now receive our offering, and we'll be hearing music from Matthew. Thank you. Okay, please stand as you're able and join us all in hymn number 360 in the big book. Here we have gathered. Please join me in responsive reading 649, also from the Green Hymnal. I will read the non-italicized, and you respond with the italicized. 649, from generation to generation. In a house which becomes a home, one hands down and another takes up the heritage of mind and heart, laughter and tears, musings and deeds. Love, like a carefully loaded ship, crosses the gulf between the generations. Therefore, we do not neglect the ceremonies of our passage, when we wed, when we die, and when we are blessed with a child. When we depart, and when we return, when we plant, and when we harvest. Let us bring up our children. It is not the place of some official to hand to them their heritage. Others impart to our children knowledge and ideals, they will lose all of us that is worldless and full of wonder. Let us build memories in our children, lest they drag out joyless lives, lest they allow treasures to be lost because they have not been given the keys. We live not by things, but by the meeting of things. It is needful to transition passwords from generation to generation. Now we'll hear the reflection from Reverend Johnstone, Welcoming Home, Rediscovering Heritage.
Good morning. So Jews have just celebrated Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, and are now in the midst of what's called the Days of Awe, which will end with Yom Kippur, or the Day of Atonement, next weekend. This is the holiest time of year for religious Jews. If there is one day in the year when they are in the synagogue, it is Yom Kippur. Synagogues are packed. Observant Jews spend hours there. Hours. Tiny groups of Jews in far-flung places fly in seminary students to lead services. I know this because friends of mine used to get flown in when we were in seminary. Even those who don't offer the traditional prayers may find themselves reflecting on how they've fallen short and how they want to improve their lives in the coming year. This is why it matters when we schedule interfaith events to pay attention to holidays that we may not know a lot about. There's a Jewish song that I associate with this time of year. Return again, return again, return to the land of your soul. Return again, return again, return to the land of your soul. Return to who you are, return to what you are, return to where you are born and reborn again. Return again, return again, return to the land of your soul. It reminds me of the coming home that many Jews do at Yom Kippur as they return to synagogue, a connection with heritage. We all have a need for such a reconnection, whatever traditions we come from. And how can we understand ourselves without understanding where we have come from? As we've talked about welcome this month, we've brushed up against the concept of home. And we may feel most welcome in our home, whether it's a family home, a religious home, or even a home state. We speak about feeling at home, where we are welcomed. And this is the time of year for homecoming, that weekend that people go back to schools where they graduated from, to their hometowns, to places where they have long roots. In a house that becomes a home, said the reading, one hands down and another takes up the heritage of mind and heart, laughter and tears, musings and deeds. We may have different heritages, but our heritages are passed down and taken up in our homes. But home and heritage may not be as simple and straightforward as we think. Heritage is what has been inherited. There are churches and religious groups who are very strong on heritage, especially in ethnic churches. The St. Bridget of Sweden Catholic Church in Lindsborg, the German Mennonites scattered across Kansas, or Hmong or Hispanic Baptist churches. Many times these groups hold on to their language for decades after immigration and to their cultural items like food for generations. A Facebook friend of mine recently asked the question, what food always gets served at your family reunions? And the answers varied as widely as you might imagine. Pierogies, tamales, oysters, jello, pizza, biscuits, gumbo. Each family has its particular heritage influenced by its culture. Culture's a funny thing because the more you are in a culture, the harder it is to identify the qualities of that culture. If you grew up with it and that's the way it is, that's just the way it is. It's normal. It's not cultural, it's normal. You don't know it's cultural until you meet other people who don't do it the same way. Whether it's how close you stand when you talk, to what foods you eat on holidays, to what kind of dishes and utensils you use to eat, to what you say when you offer a toast, or if you even do. Culture is often associated with ethnicity, but we also speak of gay culture, working class culture, youth culture, even workplace cultures. Organizations are said to develop their own particular culture, their way of being. Culture matters in the conversation about welcome because we are most likely to feel welcome when the welcome is culturally consistent with what we consider welcoming. It can be as obvious as hug versus handshake versus nod, and so subtle that we can't even name what's wrong, it just doesn't feel right. Because we are certain, we know what is normal. It's what is culturally right to us. There's a British ad that I've seen more than once where a British businessman is eating with his Japanese colleagues and he keeps struggling to finish the eels that they bring him. Because to be polite in his culture means to eat everything on his plate. Meanwhile, they keep bringing him bigger and bigger eels because to be polite in their culture means to feed the guest until he can't eat anymore, leaving something on his plate. So while he's trying to leave nothing, they're trying to get him to leave something, and the eels keep getting bigger. Culture matters. And there's the story Denise Duhamel tells of her multicultural marriage in her prose poem, Yes. Let me read it for you. According to Culture Shock, a guide to customs and etiquette of Filipinos, when my husband says yes, he could also mean one of the following. A, I don't know. B, if you say so. C, if it will please you. D, I hope I have said yes unenthusiastically enough for you to realize I mean no. You can imagine the confusion surrounding our movie dates, the laundry, who will take out the garbage, and when. I remind him I'm an American, that all these yeses sound alike to me. I tell him here in America we have shrinks who can help him to be less of a people pleaser. We have two-year-olds who love to scream no when they don't get their way. I tell him in America we have a popular book. When I say no, I feel guilty. Should I get you a copy, I ask. He says yes, but I think he means if it will please you. i.e., I won't read it. I'm trying, I tell him, but you have to try too. Yes, he says, then makes tempo, a sulking that the book Culture Shock describes as subliminal hostility, withdrawal of customary cheerfulness in the presence of one who has displeased him. The book says it's up to me to take things all, to make things all right, to restore goodwill, not by talking the problem out, but by showing concern about the wounded person's well-being. Forget it, I think, even though I know if I'm not nice, tempo will quickly escalate into nagdadabag, foot stomping, grumbling, the slamming of doors. Instead of talking to my husband, I storm off to talk to my porcelain Kuan Yin, the Chinese goddess of mercy, that I bought on Canal Street years before my husband and I started dating. The real Kuan Yin is in Manila, he tells me. She's called Nuestra Señora de Guaya. Her Asian features prove that Christianity was in the Philippines before the Spanish arrived. My husband's telling me this tells me he's sorry. Kuan Yin seems to wink, congratulating me. My short prayer worked. Will you love me forever, I ask, then study his lips, wondering if I'll be able to decipher what he means by yes. Religion and culture often get blended together. I already mentioned ethnic churches, but it's a lot broader than that. Irish Catholic, Tibetan Buddhist, Greek Orthodox, New York Jew. The connections between culture and religion may be particularly marked in Judaism. Gary Tobin of the Institute for Jewish and Community Resource claims this: the dichotomy between religion and culture doesn't really exist. Every religious attribute is filled with culture, every cultural act filled with religiosity. Synagogues themselves are great centers of Jewish culture. After all, what is life really about? Food, relationships, enrichment. So is Jewish life. So many of our traditions inherently contain aspects of culture. Look at the Passover Seder. It's essentially great theater. Jewish education and religiosity bereft of culture is not as interesting. Now, Judaism may not be the best example of how culture and religion interacts because Even though it's defined as a religion, it's also an ethnicity. Mexican Catholics don't quit being Mexican if they quit believing in God and leave Catholicism behind. In a similar way, Jews don't quit being Jewish when they become secular. Or as one diversity office put it, not all Jews practice Judaism. We can't set aside those connections between religion and ethnicity, between religion and culture, but they're not the whole thing. In terms of religion, I would guess that our religion, Unitarian Universalism, was not inherited through culture by very many people in this room. Anybody? Okay. Three. That's about right. We are much more about individual choice than we are about heritage, at least when it comes to religion. I left behind my Southern Baptist connection, which is intertwined for me with gospel hymns, exclusivism, American patriotism, and eating fried chicken and okra. I have had to work hard intellectually and emotionally to begin to pull the threads apart. I still love the hymns, even though the words make me wince. I'm repelled by the exclusivism, ambivalent about the patriotism, and still love fried chicken and okra. Even though I've rejected much of what is associated with it, I remain a cross-cultural Southerner, though I've set aside the Baptist part. I mentioned homecoming earlier. My partner Jane was back in Davis, Oklahoma last week, where she graduated from high school. It happened to be homecoming week, so she helped to put together a homecoming parade float for her high school class. Everyone was a lot older, of course. There were many of these people she had not seen in decades. Yet there was a certain familiarity about them. They told stories of high school antics and looked at pictures of grandchildren, a pleasant reunion. At the same time, though, Jane experienced a disconnection. They were no longer her people. She had left the small town behind. And a lot of us, feel that way about our heritage. It's ours, it's familiar, yet somehow that's not quite me anymore. We are big on choice, individual choice, and not so big on what we've inherited. And the challenge with that is that if we do not understand where we came from, we cannot understand and embrace who we are. Even if we are reactive against where we came from, pushing all of it aside, it is influencing and affecting us. We can't really set it aside. I think, for example, of a very educated man I know who was raised thoroughly working class, the first in his family to get a college degree, still the most educated among his family. Culturally, he has reacted so strongly against his background that I can hardly understand what he says because he always speaks in polysyllabic words and long sentences as if to prove that he does not come from the working class. What's more, if we do not find our own heritage to claim, we will go looking for it somewhere. And that is when we're at most at risk for misappropriating or misusing the heritage of others. And don't get me wrong, appreciating other cultures is fine. We have to be careful, though, about claiming them, which would yield another entire reflection that I will keep myself from offering now. Two factors make claiming our heritage challenging for Unitarian Universalists: our individualism and our commitment to unity. Both are commendable parts of our religion. Let me start with how commitment to unity can be a problem. Too often in that commitment, we rush too quickly to, we're all the same after all. It's a sentiment that can be helpful in some situations. When we're rescuing everyone, not just our own family, from the hurricane or earthquake, for example. But at the side of that homecoming float, it mattered to Jane that her life had been so different from those of her classmates. She had not married a man and had children and grandchildren. She had lived different places and had other experiences. In such a setting, it can be hard to be different if we really feel different, especially when it's supposed to be our home, can make us feel like we don't belong. And that conviction that we're all really just the same may reinforce that and obscure real differences that mattered. Maybe those differences need to be worked through, and maybe they simply need to sit side by side with an acknowledgement that we're different. That sentiment that we're all the same, after all, threatens those with less power or more difference the most. We need to always remember that we're as different as we are alike. Otherwise, we may schedule that important get-together on Yom Kippur and be surprised when the Jews don't come. In some ways, individualism is another side of that. Over and over, I see in Unitarian Universalism the elevation of the individual. We speak about the importance of individual conscience and choice, which is great. I don't want to set it aside. I want to balance it, though, recognizing that we are not entirely self-made. We came from somewhere. We have a heritage, and it matters in terms of who we are. And because most of us in UU congregations come from outside Unitarian Universalism, we bring our different cultural understandings with us. Ancestry.com and similar sites promise to help us discover who we are. The ads show how people had misunderstood their origins and how Ancestry led them to connect with relatives they hadn't known and found new aspects of themselves. And these ubiquitous ads show the people with ethnic costumes and belongings. Now, I've run the DNA test. Has anybody else, has other people run their DNA? It's a fun, kind of fun thing to find out. Turns out I'm more English than most British people. though there is a fair chunk of German in there that I knew about already, and a way, way back smattering of some other European groups. One of the things, though, that has greatly shaped me is that my genes are not my full heritage, because my father was adopted. And I have reason to believe that his birth family and adoptive family were fairly close together in heritage. I know the adoptive family, too, was British, tracing its connections to this continent as far back as the American Revolution, though his adoptive father did come from Canada. There were real class differences between the two families, though. His adoption caused me to ask some big questions about where I came from and what the effects of that were. What if he hadn't been adopted by a family who had money during the Depression? I've seen the picture of him as a young adult with his biological brothers and sisters, where he looks crisp and preppy, and they look downtrodden and poor. And he stands out as different from his biological family. Would he have even survived with the childhood illnesses he struggled through? How did his advantages confer advantage on me? No one saw life as more of a gift than my father did. And that may be because of his adoption. That's a piece of my heritage that I hold on to and value, something that might not be described as cultural, but that I certainly think of as part of my heritage. Maybe it's natural as we age to become more aware of how where we come from has shaped who we were. When we're young, we try to differentiate from our families so that we become our own person. As we age, we watch our ancestors die and feel our own connections with them. Our mother's smile, our father's chin, the mannerisms of our grandfather all shine back at us from the mirror. Langston Hughes wrote of the importance of knowing your heritage, where you came from, in his poem, Aunt Sue's Stories. Aunt Sue has a head full of stories, Aunt Sue has a whole heart full of stories. Summer nights on the front porch, Aunt Sue cuddles a brown-faced child to her bosom and tells him stories. Black slaves working in the hot sun, and black slaves walking in the dewy night, and black slaves singing sorrow songs on the banks of a mighty river mingle themselves softly in the flow of Aunt Sue's voice, mingle themselves softly in the dark shadows that cross and recross Aunt Sue's stories. And the dark-faced child listening knows that Aunt Sue's stories are real stories. He knows that Aunt Sue never got her stories out of any book at all, but that they came right out of her life. The dark-faced child is quiet of a summer night, listening to Aunt Sue's stories. This is what it is to hand down and take up the heritage of mind and heart, laughter and tears, musing and deeds, to hear the stories and take them in, to tell the stories and pass them on, the real stories from the head and the heart, the stories of slaves singing sorrow songs, the stories of a young immigrant striking out in a new land, the stories of the synagogue on Yom Kippur, the stories of the Depression and the war, whichever war, the stories of birth and adoption and marriage and death, the stories rich with cultural symbols and individual quirks. We know the real stories when we hear them, because they are specific and embedded in their place, and they transcend and connect in a human way. We most know them, though, when they are ours. At this time, if Jean is willing to get the microphone again, and if you are willing, I invite you to share stories you have discovered of your own heritage and what it has meant to you. So wait for the mic and tell us who you are.
My husband gave me a wonderful present once. He looked into my genealogy. And my maiden name is Kale, C-A-L-E. And that's my father's family. We were always told we were Scottish. So my husband found out that my great-great-great-grandmother was half Indian. And her father was an Indian chief named Kukwamukwa. And their tribe was the Skaruva, who the white people called it Tuscarora. And Kukwamukwa took the name. The Tuscarora were removed from North Carolina. And my great-great-great-grandmother had my exact name, Sylvia Kale. And so my father's been dead a long time. I always wondered, did they know that? But they knew that we were part Indian, but we thought we were Cherokee. But anyway, Kukwamukwa took the name Kale. He adopted the name of a white man he admired. That's the story. And so my daughters said, so we're not Kales. So yeah. They said when they look in the mirror, they say, well, who are we?
My brother's wife did like a ancestry thing, and I knew my grandmother's name was Kennedy. I didn't know we were related to the Kennedys, the Washington Kennedys. So we were related there partly. My heritage is basically remembering my father eating pistachios back when they were pink, red, because I think someone said there's something about we don't get them from that particular country anymore because we fighting with them or something. But yeah, but my mom's from the South, my dad's from New York. So that's an interesting combination of heritage.
I totally get that. My dad's from Maine and my mother's from Oklahoma. That's why I'm a cross-cultural Southerner.
I Well, since you're on the theme, my mom is from Minnesota and my dad was from Tennessee, so, and his family is Southern.
Both my parents had grandparents from East Germany, so I'm glad I'm not just from the southwest of Germany, but have this other piece in me. All my grandparents were dead when I was born, other than one grandmother who died when I was five, so I really don't know a whole lot about my, especially paternal grandparents. My mother always talked about her family. My dad didn't, not once. And it took me a long time to realize that people of their generation really had no problem to talk about those who were, like most Germans, close to the Nazi party. But I think my dad was really ashamed because his father was a socialist and his mother also was involved in some kind of resistance, but they never talked about that. I always thought, well, they don't talk about Nazis, but it was actually the other way around. They would talk about that part, but they were ashamed to talk about the other part. So I still do not know much about my paternal grandparents, and I really would like to find out more about them.
My story is about the heritage of all of us. In 1962, after several years of debate and work, the Unitarians and Universalists decided to perhaps that they might join. And in, I think it was in Boston, but it may have been someplace else, the Unitarian delegates were in one room, the Universalist delegates in another, the ministers in a third room waiting for the vote, and it had to be 80% of each group to be finalized. When it was finalized, somebody in the group started singing the song we are going to close with this morning as Tranquil Streams, and they sang it over and over and over again. The story is reported that men and women in the audience were all, you know, having to quit singing for a while they dealt with their emotions, but enough of them could keep it going for quite a long time.
I'm afraid maybe we might as well end there and launch into that. But before that final hymn, I just remind you briefly of Antoine de Saint-Exupéry's words, "We live not by things, but by the meaning of things. It is needful to transmit the passwords from generation to generation." And now hymn number 145, "As Tranquil Streams." With words from the Gaelic runes, "Deep peace of the running wave to you, deep peace of the flowing air to you, deep peace of the quiet earth to you, deep peace of the shining stars to you, deep peace of the infinite peace to you. Amen.